The hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I'll call this meeting of the Ag Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. A quorum is present, and take a look at the minutes, members. If that doesn't show bipartisanship, it's pretty good. So do we have a motion to approve the minutes? How about Representative Jacob?
I'll move to approve the minutes.
Representative Jacob moves to approve the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion, minutes approved. And again, quorum is present. We have a couple of bills to hear, but first we're going to hear an update from the Office of Broadband, which is under the jurisdiction of our committee. So welcome to the Ag Committee, and identify yourselves for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair. My name is Bree Mackey, and I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Broadband Development at DEED, which is the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
And Nathan Ratner, I'm in Government Relations with the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
So again, thank you for the opportunity to be in front of you and share the work we've been doing at the office over the last year. It's always an honor and privilege to be in front of you and share the work that you all set before us. So with that, we'll go through our slide deck. I show this every year, so sorry for the redundancy of many of you who have been on this committee for a while, but as a reminder, we are governed under statutory goals and statutory language, which was created when the office was created. And we do have our office itself, which was created in 2013. And with that, we also have a governor's broadband task force that we do provide administrative and technical support for. We have a very robust data and mapping program that has been even longer since 2008. The state has been mapping out broadband infrastructure. And finally, tools that the legislature has given us through our infrastructure grants, which is border to border, as well as some digital equity work that we do. So as I stated, our office is in front of you, established in 2013. We now have 10 staff scattered across the state of Minnesota who work and are able to do that because of broadband access, so thank you. We have programs such as I mentioned, the border to border, the low population line extension, as well as we did receive Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, so IIJA funding, BEAD, which is Broadband Equity, Access and Deployment, which I know many of you are familiar with, as well as the Digital Equity Act that was under the same legislation. However, that was commenced May 9th of 2025 by the U.S. Department of Commerce. So just before we get in the weeds with the specifics on the program, I also just want to highlight a lot of the work that we've been doing. All of this is within our annual report, which is posted online, so feel free in your quiet time to read that report. However, I want to just highlight a few things. So we did close out over 58 projects in 2025. And with that, we also had line extension program, and we saw 13 of those projects close, and you can see the impact that that has. Those are direct to the home, so people's lives immediately changing by broadband access. I'm going to jump a little bit to the BEAD one that's highlighted and share that we did have 18 rounds of curing when the policy notice changed. We'll go into that in a little bit more detail. And then we also updated our interactive map, so something that we try to do very often. On the next slide, also some additional things that we are very proud of is the field validations of over 70 grant projects. This includes annual monitoring as well as closeouts that we do. Over 35,000 locations were visited and tested to ensure that they have the broadband that they need. And that is laid out in the program. The Broadband Task Force, as I mentioned, we provide technical administrative support for them. We also created a broadband permitting and land use group, and I'm going to share a little more about that later, but we did have over 9 meetings, and this was really based on internet service providers and other advocates and partners who wanted to really see some more coordination with our state agencies. We do update a B contractor list, and then finally, we have 50 telecommuter forward communities in the state now. So those are some of the highlights, but we do need to talk about the unaddressed needs in Minnesota still. So as you know, the statutory language for the 2026 goals is 100 by 20 for all BSLs to be served. As of right now in December, when this was updated, 121,000 homes were without access of 25.3 and 155,000 BSLs without access of 100 by 20. You can also see that I left the numbers from 2024 so you can directly see the impact of the broadband grants are having. However, remember that there is public or private industry still investing in broadband and other federal programs, so it's not all specific just to our program, but we are moving the needle. And then finally, because there's often a lot of confusion with the BEAD program and how many locations are eligible, eligibility is based on NTIA's guidelines, and of those locations up above, only about 75,000 are eligible for BEAD. So those are the ones we look that we need to fund in that program. All right, so the next slide, I know it's really hard to see, but it is a snapshot of the state of Minnesota. And paying particularly close eye to the red areas, those are locations that do not have 25.3, so are considered unserved. The purple is underserved, which is 100 by 20, and then, of course, the served areas. This is a big snapshot, so if you zoom in on the maps, it's, you know, not perfect. There are definitely locations all over the state, but this gives you an idea of the hardest areas to serve. In the next slide, it gives a little bit more detail, and one thing that I do want to highlight is up on top, this is the 25.3. So you can see statewide that 93.8% have the 25x3, but if you look at the numbers in the rural areas, only 85.2 have 25.3. So important to note the disparity there. The following slide shows the 100 by 20 in a more visual way. And with that, 80% of greater Minnesota is lacking the 100 by 20. So again, 92% statewide. However, when you get down to rural communities, it is even less of a percentage. As I mentioned, we do have a very robust mapping program, and we have on our website a pretty easy hub that you can use to go in and look and see what programs are available if you don't have service, if you do have service. We are happy always to run reports based on your congressional district as well. So if you want to get more in the weeds, but we can go on here and pull up a address or a BSL and be able to find out what service they currently have available, if they have enforceable commitments, whether through one of our grant programs or through another federal program. And so it is an opportunity for us when we do have a resident or somebody call and ask about their location to connect them to the appropriate options they have, but also an opportunity for us to talk about the line extension with them and get them signed up for that if they truly would be an eligible location that doesn't have access to a provider to provide the services based on statutory language. So let's move to the next slide. As I mentioned, we're going to go through each of the programs very quickly, but you can see the state programs that the legislature has appropriated funds for that we run, and then the federal programs that are run through our office. As I mentioned, the border-to-border grant program and the low population density program are the two programs besides the line extension, which we will talk about a little later, but they do provide funding match to internet service providers for eligible expenses. So the traditional border-to-border provided up to 50% public private partnership match, and then the lower population is up to 75%, and that's because you all and the state realize the most difficult, expensive, and hardest places to serve are continuing to be left behind. The 75% makes more of a financial ask of our providers and incentive for them to build in these remote areas. As you can see, I mentioned again, we did over 70 grant projects this last year, verifying, doing field validations, annual reporting, and spot checks of 35,000 locations across the state. And we do work with Connected Nation, that is our mapping vendor that helps us during that process. And within the history of the Border to Border Grant Program, we have done 10 rounds. Currently, we have rounds 7 through 10 that are still open that have not been completed fully. But you can see through those 10 rounds, the legislature has appropriated over $400 million in investment. And it's really important to look at the local match as well. These are the partnerships of the internet service providers putting match dollars in, local units of government who are also putting match dollars in, and then also almost 120,000 locations have been served. There are some numbers as of February 6th as far as just specifics to our projects, but in the last 8 months, we have closed over 48 grants. And we plan to close in the next couple months 47 more that were either to be done by the end of 2025, and we're going through all of the receipts, spot checks, going out and doing all of the field work so we can get those closed. We'll move on to line extension. Reminder, in 2022, the legislature did create this program, and this is really about connecting unserved locations from an existing broadband infrastructure straight to the location itself. So maybe the line went across the street, but didn't quite get to your home for whatever reason it is. This is an opportunity for the residents themselves to register for this program. This program provides up to $25,000 per BSL. In an average, we're looking at more of around the $5,000. And then we'll snap into the next one, which really breaks it out even more. We've done a total of 4 rounds now, making our 4th round at the end of December. So again, 39 counties were impacted by the 4th round of line extension with over 1,600 locations. You can also see the local match on there. One thing I do want to point out is we do plan to do a line extension 5. Dollars for this program were appropriated by the Capital Projects Funds, and those dollars need to be all expended by the end of December of this year. And so we have been working with U.S. Treasury to make sure that we are able to get those dollars out very quickly. So we will move forward with another line extension. Now, our ISPs only have a year to build, so it's going to be very aggressive. We're going to have to shorten the timelines for providers that are able to move forward with projects. However, the deliverables will not change and the requirements will not change. We just don't want to leave any money on the table.
Ms. Mackey, could I stop you for just a second? I have a question on the line extension program. I was made aware last week from somebody back home that they were being assessed an additional fee because their service was still with copper. And she wasn't very happy with that, and I understand. And did some checking, and it turns out this is in Stearns County, and they did a pretty good program to extend broadband out to the western areas of Stearns County. But this particular township didn't go along with that program when they did it. And now, maybe having some second thoughts, is there any way this program could help folks in that township that didn't get served in the first go around?
Well, thank you, Chair. I would say we would have to look at the locations, and we certainly can take a closer look at the township and make sure that they don't have service already available. If they already have service, then this program wouldn't overbuild on those locations. But if it is something that would be eligible for, we would certainly want to get those locations signed up. I will say we do plan to look at doing some mailers and really target locations that are eligible for line extension that were part of the BEAD process and that maybe are only getting satellite or not the statutory language goals that we have in the state of Minnesota. So I would be more than happy to work with Stearns and that township.
I'll check with you offline, okay? Question from Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering, you'd mentioned the difficulty of signing up, Representative Jerry Anderson. Have the tariffs had any impact on the cost for broadband on either the hardware or just installation?
Good. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question, Co-Chair Hansen. So we have not seen anything yet as far as current construction. However, we have been made notified as far as BEAD, and that would be national, that some of the suppliers are challenged. I would say first and foremost, part of the BEAD program was BABA, so Buy America, Build America, first. So that wouldn't necessarily be impacted by the tariffs. However, we have been told that there are possibly shortages there because of other uses for the equipment, such as data centers, et cetera, which is then going to impact the need to get possibly some sort of waiver from NTIA for projects that wish to purchase supplies that are not BABA compliant. So more to come as we're doing that. But yes, I do think that supplies in general are of concern.
Any other member questions before we get into the federal program? Very important to people back home that they have their service. So, okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And I will just say, encourage people to sign up for line extension or call our office. We take applications over the phone. We'll take them by paper. We'll take them online as well. We want to make sure we're capturing every location. And at the minimum, even if they're not eligible for line extension, it's an opportunity for us to connect them to possible other opportunities or options that they may have. All right, so as I mentioned, the BEAD program, originally our allocation, as you recall, a lot of talk around $652 million. That is still Minnesota's allocation. But on June 6, we were notified by Department of Commerce of policy change to the program. So we were actually in our first round last year. I think I presented to all of you. However, when the policy notice came, we did have to halt and essentially start over. We had until September 4th to submit a new plan on how we would serve all 75,000 locations based on policy changes. We did meet that deadline. NTIA approved our final proposal in December. And 2 weeks ago, I received our notice of award notice from NIST, which is another federal partner within Commerce, telling us we can move forward. So we have 6 months to contract with all of our grantees that were preliminarily awarded within this round. You can see on this location that the grant amount now, because of the policy notice and the tech neutral approach we had to take with the policy notice, that grant request from our applicants was only $378 million. So there is a gap between that and the $652 million. We have not received guidance from NTIA yet on how those, what they're calling non-deployment dollars, can be used for. I get questions all the time from folks. Why am I getting this? Why don't you award more that? I can't. Based on the parameters that we have right now under the guidance of NTIA. So once we receive guidance under how we can use those dollars, we will work on a work plan. My guess is it will be around infrastructure in some component, but again, we have not received official guidance on how we use those dollars. So the percentages, as you can see, out of those that are awarded under the 75,000, 58% will receive fiber, 25% low orbiting satellites or LEOs, and 17% fixed wireless. Again, we did need to go by the lowest cost application to meet priorities within the policy notice changes. We tried as best we can to have some certain criteria that we were allowed to do to bump up the type of broadband that folks would receive. All right, within BEAD itself, so the next steps within that is, as I mentioned, we received our notice of funding award. We do need to sign that within 30 days, so I have just a couple more weeks to sign that. But simultaneously, we have 6 months to contract with our grantees. So working on finalizing contract language, there are state and federal requirements that we need to ensure that are in all of these contracts. There is still guidance coming from our federal partners, especially around AI and what onerous would mean as far as guidelines within our contracts. And most recently, some concerns around our rural electric co-ops and make ready. And so there are still some things that are being worked out with NTIA and how we're able to contract. We continue to design our grants management system that our grantees, when they were applicants, were able to use, so a central location. We are preparing permitting and environmental documentations. There are rules within this program to follow NEPA, which is the National Environmental Protection Act. And then we are doing our best to communicate, engaging with ISPs and communities and residents on what BEAD looks like based on the guidelines within that program that are different than our state programs. In the beginning, I did address one of the things we're really proud of is the broadband charter. And so what that really was bringing a coordinated effort of all of these state agencies together to talk, prepare, and work through broadband-specific issues when it comes through the permitting and land use components. So this group is meeting once a month. It's really to help prepare them, help prepare us ways of partnering. The other thing is out of this group came that the Office of Broadband really needed more capacity when it came to this, and we did hire a land use permitting coordinator who happens to be an archaeologist and has all the credentials necessary for the NEPA program, so the federal program. So really lucky to have Megan on our team with her expertise. So already working through state programs, so it's not just limited to BEAD, but if there is an issue or concerns with one of our state grantees that would like to talk through, we're able to coordinate that and work with them. And within that specifically, and having that staff person on our team, we can, again, connect our grantees with the appropriate agencies, help guide them through the permitting requirements, conduct initial assessments on a project and where locations may have impacts, and then just in general, preparing consultation materials, organizing, and just, again, I think really connecting folks. As I mentioned, we did have our Digital Equity Act funding, which helped us produce the Digital Opportunity Plan. That plan is a Minnesota plan. It is still active. However, we don't have any grant funding, and we're not issuing any grants. However, when this was developed, it really was grassroots based on the communities across the state. So we still care deeply about the vision, our goals that were in there, but again, there is no funding tied to this program. As I mentioned, we do support the Governor's Broadband Task Force, which has 15 members from cross sectors of different areas across the state that make a recommendation to you all, the legislature and the governor each year. Their report is on our website. Happy to connect you to Chair Bekele if you have additional questions. But we just, again, provide technical assistance and administrative assistance to that team. And finally, looking ahead, as always, if you are ever able to visit with any of the team members, we really do are very proud to represent this office and the work that we do every day. We take this very seriously, as I mentioned. Many of us live in rural communities, myself included, who do not have statutory language broadband access at this time. But we will continue throughout the year administering the BEAD program as required. And within the policy rules, continue to advance our border-to-border and our line extension programs. And then I just want to highlight two things is we in April are hosting again our Navigating Plus, which is a permitting land use and state system series that we bring in other of those agencies that were listed, and they will work with us and do a webinar. Folks can ask questions directly of those agencies. And then those are also posted online for reference for any of our internet service providers or partners. And then finally, there is a connecting one Minnesota Broadband Summit at the Heritage Center on April 29th. The morning will be more general session. The afternoon will have breakout sessions that are going to be somewhat specific to BEAD and how contracts will work, so our internet service providers, and then also mapping, permitting, and all those. So really trying to capture that all in one place. So with that, that is what I have for slides. Again, thank you for the opportunity to be here and happy to take questions.
Thank you. Question from Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. So a couple of quick questions. Of course, out in my area, we've got an awful lot of citizens who are on either the, I guess what you call LEO or fixed wireless. So do you know what the cost per location is currently, that as each location you reach, and what you might expect that to go to as we try to get to these much harder to reach places, which, you know, the reason we haven't got to them is because they are so hard to reach. So what's the current cost per location at, and what do you see that moving to as we get to harder to reach places?
Ms. Mackey?
Thank you, Chair Anderson, and thank you, Representative Jacobs. So I would say I can go to the BEAD program specifically, but I can also go back to our state program and run some average numbers for you if you would like. Within the BEAD program itself, when the LEOs came in, they did not apply during our program, so they were negotiated during afterwards, and we had both of them, so Amazon Broadband as well as Starlink participated, and both were awarded. It seems that the average cost for, at least in that application, is somewhere between the $900 and $1,800. However, it is still unsure to us what we are paying for within that. We're waiting for guidance. We cannot pay for equipment, and we cannot pay for monthly fees. So if you're talking specific to LEOs, because we generally don't never fund them in our state program because they can't meet the statutory requirements and they aren't wireline. So that's what I know within the BEAD program. As far as the fixed wireless, I would have to dig a little bit more closely to do an average. But you can see just on the next, I think it's the next, no. Yeah, oh, that is the slide. So you can see it's a little skewed by the 490 location. We did have some applications with a penny because they were already going to be building in some of those areas, so to hold that location. So those numbers are skewed, but the average cost in BEAD was about $5,000, but that included everything.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. So the average cost for fiber is around $5,000 per household?
Ms. Mackey?
Yes, thank you, Chair.
Yes.
So this would include all of the technologies within this particular number. I would say line extension has been, and that's a great place to look at averages, somewhere around the 5,000 to 6,000 location range as of right now. And that's more direct DSL. And we could pull that by county, those numbers. What does line extension on an average that we've funded in Winona County look like? If you would like that, I just don't have it in front of me. I will point out the highest cost location for BEAD that we did put forward is the 36,000. It's a very difficult area to serve in the state of Minnesota. We had numbers and justification for that. However, that was not accepted by NTIA. Our average, the highest cost there was around the $22,000 is the highest they would let us fund with BEAD for BSL.
Representative Jacob?
One follow-up. So that if we're at 58% total served with fiber, what is the goal? What are we trying to get to? And does it make more sense to be trying to reach with fiber at a minimum of $5,000? And it's only going to get, we've only reached the easy ones, right? The hard ones are yet to come. So what's the goal that we're trying to get to with fiber? And is it cost effective compared to LEOs and fixed wireless?
Ms. Mackey, the big question.
It is a big question. Thank you, Chair Anderson and Representative Jacobs. I think your point is well taken. BEAD is its own thing, has its own requirements and its own guidance. If I look at state statutory language and the goal within our programs is everybody at 100 by 20 scalable and wireline. But within BEAD, it was A, were there applications there? We tried to fund as many fiber as we possibly could. That were in front of us and that we could justify the cost and that NTIA would allow us to do. However, part of the policy notice change was looking at cost overall, and often the lowest cost one. The only difference our state had that is a little different is, again, we didn't have LEOs participate in our official grant round, so they weren't priority, but we knew we needed them to reach all 75,000, and they came in and negotiated afterwards. So it's a complicated thing. If you look at ours and our state program, absolutely, that's how we funded, and that's our goal. With BEAD, we tried really hard to align that with the border-to-border as best we could within the parameters of what they would allow us to do. We did that before the policy notice. We had three rounds. The first round was fiber-only applications, so we were trying to max that out. However, with the policy notice on June 6th, we were not allowed to take that approach. It had to be net tech neutral.
Representative Jacobs.
Just one last.
You said that last time.
Very, very last. So the LEOs and fixed wireless, are they meeting the state's requirements on speeds?
Ms. Mackey.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and Representative Jacobs. So not our state standard for speeds, no. Within the program of BEAD, are they meeting the minimum requirements there? Yes.
That was it. Okay. Promise.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few questions, three exactly. First of all, I'd like to know, I know why we're doing this into the rural areas. It's a lot of agriculture, a lot of people wanting to work from home, and then out into like local businesses that can benefit. You know, so we can think of the why behind this. Would you be willing to share one or two success stories that you've seen firsthand out into these districts?
Ms. Mackey.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Anderson, and great question. So, Representative. So, one story that I think I've been sharing quite a bit on, not specific to a person or BSL, but is around our child care shortage, and especially in greater Minnesota. If you're working 12-hour days from home caring for our young children, it is very challenging for you to get in and do your continuing educations or licensing requirements at a physical location. Having internet allows them to do that from their residence when it works best for them and still stay credentialed and still have access for all of us to live, work in rural communities. It also is for providers that are using food programs. There's a lot of reporting, as we know, in that as well. It allows them to do that from their home as well. So I think that is provided an opportunity for us to keep many of our rural child care providers going because of those options.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Second part of my question, and this is just to show my unfamiliarity with the program, we look at these areas of the map not yet served, and the question I have is to fill those areas, is that driven by a contractor who comes to you and says, hey, I'm up to this point, I can take that next step, and go ahead and tell me what would you pay me to do that? Or do you put out an RFP? I mean, are you looking at like unserved areas and prioritizing them and you put out the RFP to contractors? What's driving the process of where do we go next?
Ms. Mackey.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, and another great question, Representative. So our grants are for internet service providers. So we do an RFP process. And what has been really successful about the program is the ISPs know where the feasibilities are in order for them to make the business case to apply for our grants. And so as they are building out with the private-public partnership, they're able to continue to expand out because their regions have expanded out. As you know, Minnesota, I say this all the time nationally, we have the best providers in the nation. These are your local rural electric co-ops, your small cable companies, your small family telcos who transition from telephone to broadband to meet the needs of their communities. I can sit next to someone from my broadband at a basketball game and hold them accountable. So I would say it's largely driven by that and the needs in the communities that they have. Often these aren't money makers. You know what a monthly fee is, though it does feel expensive. But if you're one BSL per mile, you're not going to make up that revenue very fast, which is why these programs work.
Yep. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. I know we've looked at contractors and permitting and qualifying. Have you had any issues with workforce shortages that would constrain this advance? Thank you.
Ms. Mackey.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So largely our internet service providers are doing work plans quite in advance. You'll see some models across the state where they're creating their own contractors or have within. So they are trying to kind of dodge the workforce shortage a little bit by being proactive on that. However, we know it is a challenge. And, you know, looking at BEAD and knowing nationally every state and territory is going to be doing this at the same time, it certainly is of concern. But again, I think our providers are working with local small community colleges on different programming. I'm at DEED, so certainly as much as I can help connect folks and workforce programs, we will do so. We know our labor partners are working on that. And again, there are some models of the providers collaborating together and creating it. So yes, but Minnesota's pretty creative and forward thinking.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Mackey, if we continued at, say, the amount of money we're receiving from the federal government for BEAD and then had our own, just what we've been providing over the years on average, when would we be done? When would it all be done?
Ms. Mackey.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Co-Chair Hansen. That is an excellent question. I would say before we, about a year and a half ago, we did a COSTAT analysis with a company called CTC. I think I presented last year, but with the numbers that we had at that time, we figured it'd be about $1.2 billion to finish the locations that we've identified. So if BEAD comes in and can pick up some of those, 52%, with statutory goal language, then that would still leave the remaining. It would really depend on how much the legislature or the appropriation would come to us. We've done a couple grant rounds in a year for $100 million. We also do need to recognize that our providers, which are small, need access to capital and long-term planning. So overwhelming all at once maybe isn't the key either, but I think if we could make a concerted effort over the next 4 years with, say, 125,000 or million a year, we could get it moving real fast. But it just depends. And then the other thing to Representative Jacob's point is every year it's going to cost more. So the more we push it, the more costly it will become.
Might be a little higher than our target structure, but I have one more question.
Chair Hansen.
And then maybe comparison with other states, just how are our surrounding states doing on implementation compared to us?
Ms. Mackey.
Yes, thank you, Chair and Co-Chair. I would say, you know, Minnesota has been doing this a really long time, and we're a national model. And if you go look at other states, you can see an imprint of Minnesota in that. When I am nationally traveling, you know, Minnesota is the standard. With BEAD, there are states that just opened offices and have never ran grant programs before. I think that's maybe why we, when we're working with NTA or federal partners, are a little more challenging for them because we know what to expect. We know that with RDOF, locations get missed. How are we going to change, you know, update our plans to ensure that every location is covered? And so we do have that foresight that we need in order to implement BEAD. But there are other states who have been doing it a while too, Colorado. I will say one positive thing with BEAD that's really come out is the connection that I have with every other state and territory's offices, because there's only 56 of me across the nation, and we're really learning and borrowing things from each other at this point. But I think you should all be really proud of Minnesota and the way that the legislature thought ahead long before Internet for All in BEAD.
Ms. Mackey, I have one last final question, and I guess I'm going to date myself here, but early on in the program, Border to Border, as I recall, the local landline companies would have first dibs or first chance at providing service to the area that they had with landlines. And some of them would do it, some of them didn't, and then after a couple of years, a local company could step in and make an application and then do that. Is that still the case today, or is that pretty much taking care of itself as the years have gone by?
Thank you, Chair. So I will just start with this is, before my time as well when the program started. However, I would say one thing that we look at in how we rank our applications is by local support. So if a community has an internet service provider putting an application for a program, they better have worked with the community to have that support, or we will not fund those programs. So that's one tool. But as far as specifically to your question, I think it's fixed itself. If those were easy places to go, somebody would have done it. So it really is convincing that local internet service provider to do that work.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions from members? If not, thank you for your presentation. And again, your program, or our program, is the envy of the nation, so thank you. A couple of bills on tap next, and Vice Chair Harder will assume the chairman's chair.
All right, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3548, the Farm Down Payment Assistance Grants. Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes, I'd like to move House File 3548.
Chair Anderson moves House File 3548 to be put before the committee. Chair Anderson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been talking about this bill for a while, trying to make some improvements, and I would just tell members that this is kind of a work in progress. I have a couple of changes incorporated into this version, and we're still discussing and talking, and we are amenable to make additional changes. A couple of them that really jump out at me, looking back at the history of this program, it began back in 2023. With a $500,000 grant, and there was about 21,000 left over after that grant process closed. In 2024, they had $1 million to disperse, and about half of that got dispersed. And in 2025, they had at their at the disposal of the Department of Ag $1.4 million, and the total dispersed was less than half that amount, $615,000. And this year, we've increased the appropriation to $1.25 million per year. So there is funding there. And that's one of the reasons I've talked for a couple of years trying to increase the amount if somebody would purchase a larger piece of ground. And I think the awards that we give here should be somewhat proportional to the amount it takes to get into farming, which is what the purpose of this program is. And again, out in greater Minnesota, especially if you're going to be getting into grain farming, it's going to take a number of acres, and it's expensive. And to pick up a 40 or an 80 or a quarter section takes a lot of money if you're going to jump into it. And even if you're just going to raise some livestock, cattle or hogs, you're going to have land available to spread the manure with your manure management plan. So getting your land base is extremely important. And the reason in the bill I put 75 acres is, a quarter section of land is pretty common. It's a quarter of a whole section, which is 1 square mile. And an 80 is half of the quarter of 80 acres. But sometimes with land, there are roads that come out of that total number of acres. I have an 80, for example, that's got 77.1 total acres. The other 3 acres are county road. So that's just taken out of it. So my intent was, if somebody was going to purchase what we would call an 80 acres of land, in some cases it may be a few acres less than that because of roads or whatever. So I use the word, the term 75 acres to double the award that the recipient would be given. A couple other changes made in the program. Sometimes the applicants aren't totally ready. They don't have a purchase agreement in hand. And in 2027, we're going to reserve some of the money, about half the funding, for those that have a purchase agreement in hand, so we can hopefully get more of this funding out to those that are more ready to use it when it becomes available, and then they are given an award. It also adds a little piece about requiring some knowledge of experience of agriculture. I'm not quite sure what that's going to be, but we want to make sure that if somebody gets a state grant and is going to get into agriculture, that they have somewhat of an idea of what they're getting into. It's a tough place to make a profit, but we hope that changes soon. So that's one of the additions to this bill. And there are also some about if it's zoned commercial, it must include a business plan, that type of thing. And if it's residential, it's ineligible for this type of a grant. So with that, Madam Chair, I don't know if there's testifiers, but I'll be willing to stand for questions, and would then like to hear what members have to say.
Turn it on. Thank you. Representative Godfrey had a question.
Sorry, I did not expect me to go first, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just had a couple of questions about, some of the changes. I think some of these make a lot of sense, but I'm just curious as to the rationale or how they're enforceable. So, I'm just, for lines 1.19 and 1.20, that's related to has adequate farming experience or demonstrates knowledge in this type of farming for which the farmer seeks assistance from the commissioner. I'm just curious what, how would they make that enforceable? What criteria is going to be used in order to demonstrate those knowledge? Is there going to be standardized criteria in as far as fulfilling this part of the requirements concerned?
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Good question, and again, a lot of that's going to be up to the Department of Ag and the Commissioner. One thing that comes to mind right away in some of the other programs, it's enrollment in a farm business management type program. So that would be one possibility. And then the others, I don't know if there's going to be some kind of a 10-point quiz, whatever, but just some basic knowledge of, I would say, economics of agriculture in terms of knowing what it takes to do a cash flow, that type of thing, in whatever they choose to get into, whether it be a grain operation or a vegetable operation here closer to the metro, just some basic background that they know what they're getting into.
Okay.
But that's going to have to be worked out, I think, in consultation with the department. I don't have that specific answer.
Yeah. Chair Anderson, will you bring your mic closer to you, please?
I thought I was over-modulating, but okay. Yeah, I will.
Sorry. Thank you. All right. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the effects of this bill or this revision would be to create a greater advantage for small farmers, give them the opportunity to expand their acreage and a nice solid footing for a smaller farmer, again, to expand in a little bit greater scale. Can you tell us what are the benefits of that? What's the good thing that happens when a small farmer has the opportunity to expand? What good for the state, for the region? How is that beneficial? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Anderson.
Representative Gander, obviously there's a cost savings in size, but again, this program is designed mainly for somebody just getting going. So it's going to have to be at a smaller scale, but again, even at 40 acres or 80 acres, that's pretty small. So as you would expand, get a little bit bigger, it just becomes more efficient. Your cost per acre of production would be lowered, and not just in agriculture, but really anything, profit margin, whether at the grocery store or at the sporting goods store, whatever, your profit margin is pretty slim. So, you know, that's one reason farmers have gotten bigger, is that there's less profit per unit of production. So you have to produce more units to get that level of profit up there where you can survive. But again, this program really hits at the beginning farmer, the starting out farmer, to give him kind of a little jump start in getting his operation going, not necessarily to expand, but overall that would be the goal of anybody getting involved in business, would be to expand and to make it more efficient.
Representative Gander,
follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. So it's interesting to consider that even the great big farms have to be larger to be profitable. It turns out maybe even a startup farm has to be a little bigger, you know, as that even that initial launch has to be a little bit bigger to even get a good foothold. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Godfrey, did you have a follow-up question?
I did. It's okay that we
sorry about that.
No, it's okay. Totally fine. Appreciate that extra context. I did also want to quick ask about lines 2.31 through 3.31, just to discuss the different eligibility requirements based on zoning. So if the farmland is located in an area zoned for residential use, they're prohibited. I was just curious if I had two questions related to this, because it also seems in the same section that there is questions about the charter cities versus statutory cities. Is your mind, please clarify first, if you could, whether or not cities could make up their own rules pertaining to this if there's a residential zoning, you know, within a city, could the city still allow for use of this program? Or is it that in addition to it having to be a commercial plot of land, and it also has to be, if it is in one of those cities, it then also has to be or earn at least $1,000? Or is it that if there's maybe some supremacy of the zoning, the particular zoning of the city, over what is written here, that that residential is ineligible?
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Again, very, very good question. And this proposal here came from the department. I just as soon have somebody from the department come up here and to discuss their reasoning for commercial, residential, that type of thing. That came from the department. I would just say somebody in a residential area maybe not appreciate some kind of a livestock operation in their neighborhood, but we'll let the experts talk about that.
Thank you. Please tell us, state your name and go ahead and answer the question. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and Representative Godfrey. So we actually, that piece didn't come from us on the zoning piece. But I did want to just maybe just go back quickly to your first question about how we will check farming experience. So we have our beginning farmer tax credit. We have a similar requirement. What we do right now is it is farm business management, as Representative Anderson mentioned. We also have like a 4-year degree in an ag-related field, or at least 3 years of verified farm management or working experience. So we've got a couple of ways that we check those things, but happy to talk more about that. But the zoning piece did not come from us. So I'm not familiar with that.
Thank you. Representative Gottfried?
No, appreciate that clarification, especially about the former question that I had. I guess, you know, for me, one of the things that I would be a little concerned about in this is, you know, this particular bit about the zoning is kind of siloing urban agriculture, urban farmers from being able to take advantage of this program. And I, you know, for me, as I talk about, as I like to look at regional resilience and things like that, obviously we want to create opportunities for small farmers in greater Minnesota, 100%. But also we have, you know, smaller food farmers that may want to do similar programs here within more residential areas as well. And I am a little bit concerned that, you know, these provisions here might prevent those individuals from taking advantage of that, even if they, you know, displayed all other, satisfied all of the other requirements for the program. So that would be my only comment going forward. So appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Do you have an answer?
We'll get to the bottom of this. Your point is well taken. So we will find out. And if that's a problem, be willing to work with you and remove it.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. We have several people who wish to ask questions, but let's move to our testifiers. We have two testifiers here for the bill. Would you please come to the table, state your name and your organization, and then begin your testimonies, please. Thank you.
Thank you, committee members, for allowing us to testify. My name is Laura Schreiber. I'm the Government Relations Director for Land Stewardship Project. We're a grassroots, member-led nonprofit working to create a more sustainable and just farm and food system that works for both people and the land. As Chair Anderson said, thanks to the great work of this committee, the last 3 years we've been able to create and grow this program and have had 112 farmers be able to purchase their first farm, which is super exciting, especially when you're thinking about the average age of a Minnesota farmer is 57 years old. So how can we be supporting more programs like this that are supporting the next generation of farmers in Minnesota? We appreciate some of the suggestions that Representative Anderson laid out in this bill and have a few concerns as well, so appreciate the opportunity to have a conversation on this program. Firstly, we know that including some readiness requirements and ensuring that applicants are in a good place if they do receive grant award to be able to spend that money. So having that farmer experience is definitely something that we support, whether that be through on-farm experience, agriculture degree, or a farm business management course. And also the set-aside support, having some of that money set aside for those who have a purchase agreement in hand. Instead of the 50%, though, for the second year, recommend 25% per year. So that you can have that set aside, incorporated for each year. An area of concern, and I'll let Alyssa speak to this more, but first, for the last year, the committee was able to successfully increase the grant award from $15,000 to $20,000. And then this bill, as we heard, would create another funding tier for acres or for purchases for 75 acres or more. Instead of having this based on acreage amount, we suggest setting this based on the purchase price of the land total, considering, you know, 80 acres in Pine County may be vastly different than, say, 40 acres in Renville County. So instead of having a purchase cap that can maybe have go into that second tier for funding. And then lastly, for the zoning change, we understand the intent of this, but you know, making sure that grants for land that's purchased with this is being utilized for agricultural purposes. However, this change could negatively impact farmers looking at land that's either closer to the metro or looking at smaller acreage. So I'll pass it to Alyssa, who's going to speak to that a little bit more.
Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. This is for the record. My name's Alyssa Isle, and I just spoke with Laura this morning. I run California Street Farm, which is a small vegetable farm in northeast Minneapolis. And I've been running that for the last 4 years. We grow vegetables and flowers. And Laura called me this morning to ask me some questions about how this change of this bill would negatively impact me. And I was so worried about it that I drove here to talk about this. So I would say that essentially, I just want to give you a little background. California Street Farm is a vegetable and flower farm. And in 2025, we served hundreds of customers during our 25-week season at the Northeast Minneapolis Farmers Market and our on-site farm stand. In addition, we serve 105 families through our CSA program, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And in 2026, we anticipate serving over 150 families in our CSA program. Right now, I rent a quarter of an acre, and I'm able to serve that many people in the city. And I'm able to produce about 100,000 in sales from that land, selling just growing off of that quarter acre, and pay myself as well as three seasonal employees. So that is pretty small. And I can tell you that I've been able to do that profitably, just to speak to this kind of like feeling or comment about like farms needing to be large in order to be profitable. I just don't think that's true. And there's many farmers that can show that that's true, or that it's not true, that they can be profitable on very small amounts of land. So my land that I farm on right now is zoned residential. And I would not be able to purchase it if this change were to be made utilizing the down payment assistance grant. So it definitely would have a negative impact, not only on urban farmers, but suburban farmers and anyone looking to buy smaller acreage in mixed use spaces. I called a couple of my farmer friends on the way in today and found out that they too are farming on residential properties and feel that it's already hard enough to find farmland to buy utilizing this program, and restricting it to agricultural only would just make it more difficult. So this program is a program that I'm hoping to take advantage of, as I myself shop for land. I've been in discussion with an FSA loan officer as well as a land access navigator for the last 3 months, and I'm looking at purchasing about 10 acres in Buffalo. That the down payment assistance grant is an essential component to me being able to make that purchase, as I will be taking advantage of an FSA loan. And even though my farm is profitable, I don't have 20 grand lying around to put on a down payment for 10 acres. That 10 acres that I'm looking to buy is also zoned residential, and I'm able to legally farm on that land as it's residentially zoned, but wouldn't be able to take advantage of this program if that zoning requirement were there. I would also like to point out that if there's a change in language around, if there's more funds available to larger acreages, it disproportionately like benefits larger acreage farms rather than smaller acreage farms. It's just going to make it so that those of us who are truly, truly small, like 10-acre farms, are not able to take advantage of that money. But I do think that having more funds available to farms that are of higher value, that would be maybe closer into the city, could be something that could be worked in. Like I said, one of my friends who I called on the way in here, they run 10th Street Farm in Afton, Minnesota, and they serve hundreds of families in their area. They farm all year round, and they grow on simply 3 acres, and they're also zoned residential. They provided me a list of farms that I'm going to read for you that would, you know, not be able to take advantage of this program if the zoning restrictions were put in place, essentially. So those farms are 10th Street Farm and Market in Afton, Happy Song Farm in Afton, Rebel Pickle in Afton, Black Radish Farm in Minneapolis, Cimarron Community Farm in Lake Elmo, Edgy's Veggies, Freedom Farms, California Street Farm in Minneapolis, Vessel of Posies, Minneapolis, Julia's Neighborly CSA, Minneapolis, Northerly Flora, Minneapolis, Our Roots Garden, Minneapolis. And I'll say that I am very much in support of adding more readiness requirements for this grant program. When I think about that, when I come around to applying for this grant program this year, I will have been preparing for it for a year. I would hope that, you know, I'm in a lottery with other farmers who have been putting that kind of time and dedication in, who can show a 3-year cash flow budget to prove that they can actually afford their farm and make the money work. So I definitely support more requirements, though I don't support the changing of the zoning requirement or necessarily more funds going to larger acreage properties. So one suggestion that I have along the lines of prioritizing applicants that are more ready would be to require that applicants are connected to or in conversation with a navigator. There's land access navigators that are suggested through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and they're grant funded. Those navigators can help farmers be ready and increase their percentage of actually being able to be ready and take advantage of these funds after they get them. So, thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the testimonies. Before we get back to our questions, does anybody here have questions for our two testifiers? I'm seeing none. Thank you. All right, is there anybody else sitting here in the committee room who would like to testify for or against House File 3548? All right, then we will go back to member questions. The next person on the list is Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. And I didn't have a question for the testifiers, but I want to say thank you for presenting, especially since you were not planning on doing it till today. That was a great job, so thank you. Representative Anderson, or Chair Anderson, I should say, the intent of this bill, I think, as you presented it, I think we all agree with making sure that this money is used to help folks either expand or get a foothold in a certain market. I do have some specific questions that were touched on by some testifiers in lines 2.23 and 2.24. Two specifically, and I would actually probably ask a question to the department as well if they're willing to come up one more time. I am curious how you came to limiting this to more than 2 acres just across the board. Why you chose that number for this bill, and then sort of a corollary question to the department is, would that restriction of 2 acres have affected folks who have received funds through this program to date? So that's a two-pronged question to two different people. Sorry for that, but I'd be curious responses.
Thank you. Representative Anderson?
I don't know if anybody's coming up from the department, but again, 2 acres was used. Keep in mind it was a $20,000 grant, and I believe there's also a stipulation that the grantee provide several thousand on their own. So again, is this program designed to cover pretty much the entire purchase cost? I'm not sure that's true. And I would also make just one comment. I didn't think this program was entitled the Small Farmer Down Payment Assistance Program. I think we need all kinds of farming, agriculture, and to talk about, we don't want to help big farms or bigger farms. This should be for smaller farms. I don't think that's the intent of this program. It's to help all farms, all agriculture. And the 2 acres, again, was suggested as a nominal size. I think the smallest piece of ground purchased, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was 3 acres last year. And somebody's coming up from the department to answer that. But that's where this minimum came from.
Thank you. Can you please state your name for the record?
Hello, my name is Jenny Heck, and I am the program administrator at the MDA for this program. Thank you for the question. The average farm size over the last 3 years has been 60 acres. From year to year, I would say something less than 2 is pretty rare, maybe like once or twice a year. In the last 3 years, the smallest acreage was, we had 1 urban lot that was 0.12 acres, and then in the other 2 years, the smallest farm was 2 and 1.8 acres.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
I mean, so putting those two answers together, I mean, Chair Anderson, I agree with what you're saying of that in some ways this funds is good for all agriculture, but this bill doesn't say that. This says agriculture that's more than 2 acres. And we just heard that there's at least a couple who would be out of the program if this bill passed in that way, which, you know, I don't think anyone would like to do. So I'll just leave it as I think we should take out that minimum, and we can talk about that. A follow-up question I would have to that is why the decision of acreage, using numbers of acreage rather than cost of purchase? Because as one testifier said, land is different all throughout the state. In some areas, 75 acres would be a certain amount. In other areas, it would be much more. And if you're even looking to help those larger purchases, it might be a better way of looking at land as cost rather than simply number of acres. Again, you know, the old adage, location, location, location. Land is different where you're having them. So follow-up question with that.
Thank you. Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson?
Yeah, Representative Smith. I can see that as a possibility that, you know, land varies in cost. And I just asked if the entire grant covered the purchase price of these really small acreages, and she said no, it didn't. So if it covered, I don't know, a percentage of it, but I'd still say it's a larger percentage than somebody purchasing 40 or 80 acres out in greater Minnesota. And I'm just trying to make the awards proportional, but I hear the 2 acre minimum, and that's fine with me. I want to take that out of there, fine. I'm not so concerned about that end of it. I just thought somebody who wanted to get some help buying a more traditional piece of ground out in greater Minnesota, it takes a whole lot more capital to get that 40 or 80 acre piece of ground, and that's what I was going by. But changing it to a dollar amount, yeah, if we can accomplish what we all want to get accomplished, yeah, I'd be willing to look at that, yes.
Follow-up, Representative Smith?
No, I don't think so. I appreciate that. And I think we're, again, the intent of this bill, as you've stated, I think we're on similar grounds. And I know the testifier was from the city's area, but you're saying greater Minnesota, like my area of the state, right? Like outside of Rochester and Olmsted County, we have dairy farms, a lot of land that is much more expensive than agricultural land you would find in other areas of the state, but that are used for agricultural purchases. So I'd want to make sure that folks around there are also able to, if they're getting higher amounts of land, be able to access maybe higher funding in the same way that you're thinking. That was my focus there.
Thank you. All right, next on the list is Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. I guess first question would be, what is the motion for this bill?
The motion is that it will be laid over.
Laid over, okay. And I just want to thank the testifiers and LSP for being here today and laying out some of the suggestions and concerns as well. I know I have similar questions to what my members here asked too, and so that was helpful. So I don't really have any questions, and they've already been answered. But thank you, Chair Anderson, for bringing this bill forward. I know that this program has a lot of bipartisan support. There's a lot of interest in it, and that's what I've always appreciated from colleagues from the other side of trying to always improve on this program, because it's fairly new. And as you all know, I created this program. This is my baby. And when I created this program, I intended it to really help like the small and emerging farmers, particularly micro farmers too. In the MDA, in the ag industry, there's a lot of support for traditional ag, and yet for the micro farmers, it's almost pretty much non-existent. And so hence, this is why I came up with this program, is really to support the micro farmers, who particularly are the ones who are renting, leasing the land, and have spent years farming the land that they rent from, and wants to eventually purchase their first farmland to help sustain their business operations. And they're ready for the next step. And many of these times, I grew up in a Hmong immigrant community, and English is their second language. English is my second language, and you could think it's pretty hard to kind of do all the paperwork and whatnot. And so, although I appreciate that when you said that the language you have here in this bill is working in progress and that you're open to some changes, I do appreciate that. But with some of these changes that you suggest in the bill, it seems to open up to different types of farmers, which, as you mentioned. And I would just say that if we open up to the more, I guess, traditional type of farmers, they may not necessarily need this type of support. And if we do open it up, that it will create an already disproportionate advantage for the larger farmers to kind of take over the benefits of this program versus the micro farmers that actually need this. And that's just one of my concerns. But I'm happy to continue to work on this language with you if you're interested. And also just, I share similar concerns on how this could affect urban ag farmers too as well. And I'll just leave my remarks on that, but thank you so much for working on this.
Thank you, Representative Vang. The next person on the list is Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm in a similar boat as Representative Vang, where a lot of my colleagues are asking the same questions that I had. And I also want to thank the testifier to come up and kind of share her story, because the issues that she outlined regarding zoning and the minimum acreage are some of the same concerns that I had. but I want to go back and ask a different question about the minimum experience piece, because Mr. Chair, you kind of said that you didn't have a specific criteria that we're looking for. We heard from the department say that they had similar criteria in other programs. I guess then the one question that I would have for this is, was this change for the adequate farming experience a change that you were looking for, or is that a change like the department was coming looking for? Where is that request coming from?
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I guess I have to be careful of my answer here, because I thought the other had come from the department as well. It was discussed, I think, when we look back at how much of the funding went unallocated, and there was discussion that some people kind of applied to the program and didn't have a purchase agreement, and then as it went along, they kind of lost interest and fell away, but it took time of the department, and maybe they had awarded them. So I think that's where it came from, and the department is here, and they can provide further clarification.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Frederick. So we would be very supportive of this. I think as Chair Anderson mentioned, We are finding, just as we've implemented this program, this new program over time, we've noticed that there are some folks who are in the pool that maybe just aren't quite at the point that they're ready to you know, get the land. And so it does take opportunity away from folks who are at a, in a position that are a little bit more ready. So I think we were very supportive of the 50% for purchase agreements and for the requirements in related to what we have at the beginning farmer tax credit, just to make sure we're sort of getting to the folks that are at the most ready.
Follow-up? No follow-up. All right, great. Thank you. Next one is Representative Abaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, similar situation. A lot of my colleagues have brought up some of the same questions. I think one of the things, though, that is concerning me about the way this language has been put together is it kind of is changing the entire program. And so from what I understand from Representative Vang is, like, this was meant to be a program to support farmers who don't traditionally have access to purchasing land, that they are, you know, renting land, they're using land that others have, or they're much smaller farmers that they would not be eligible for some of the larger programs provided by USDA or perhaps even in Minnesota that would allow them to purchase their land. I think as we hear from the testifiers, we also know that oftentimes a lot of these farmers are you know, fruit and vegetable farmers. They may farm flowers. They may farm things that their community needs more so than grain, which I believe you alluded to earlier in your earlier presentation about the fact that this could be opened up to grain farmers. I would just say that as we're thinking about this or whatever happens with this bill language, to really just kind of initially keep that in mind of folks who do know about the land and folks who have experience on the land, whether it's people who are from the United States and have been growing up on farmland for their entire lives, or our immigrant communities who probably also came from farming communities too. And so that's just one thing I would hope that you would keep in mind as you go back to continue to rework this bill, to just keep that original purpose in mind. Again, I do also think too that some of the requirements also appear quite restrictive. I understand the need for a purchase agreement, but one of the things I'm wondering, because what we see in the housing space sometimes is you may not necessarily have that house ready to buy, but you kind of know, but you are ready to be a purchaser, right? And so trying to see if there's a way to kind of mirror that also in the same aspect with farmland too. Anyway, those are just some things I would ask that you keep in mind as you continue the drafting process. So as we're not excluding those who have already been excluded from farmland to the benefit of those who may have the ability to seek out funding, particularly from the U.S. government. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I think we need all types of farming, and what I just heard was, you know, you're going to open this up to grain farmers? I mean, grain farmers are farmers, like somebody that raises vegetables, and I don't understand why we would exclude somebody because of the type of crop they raised, and then with the realization that it takes a larger piece of ground to operate that type of a farm. And I would just suggest also, Representative Badger talked about if they're ready to purchase but don't have a piece of ground picked out, does that mean they've already got the financing lined up? They've got a loan ready to make up the rest? I mean, there's more to it than just saying, I'm ready to buy a farm and then go ahead and do it. There's a lot of steps involved in securing financing and whatever. And I don't want to, this does not hurt a small farmer, you know, except the residential piece. Yeah, that will come out because I've heard loud and clear that is a detriment, and I will take that out. But this doesn't, and if the 2-acre piece is too large,
half an acre, whatever is satisfactory, a tenth of an acre. That's not my intent to exclude anybody. My intent is at the other end, where somebody needs to buy 80 acres to have a chance to make it. And just because he grew up on a farm doesn't mean that he's going to get that land free and clear. I mean, it probably isn't. So there's challenges in beginning farming, whether you're in the metro raising vegetables. And I think in the tax bill last year, we just allowed somebody who raises flowers to be considered an agricultural operation. They can get ag homestead, which is good. It opens it up to more people who are involved on a smaller acreage. But my point with the increase, and we did increase it from 15,000 to 20,000. Chair Hansen, we worked on that last year to increase that amount to 20,000. And again, everything is based on the relative size of the money it takes and whatever. And I just want to make it so that anybody can have a chance to get into farming.
Thank you. Just a reminder, members, that we have one more bill to come up. There are four other people who wish to ask questions. The next one on the list is Representative Lawrence.
Thank you, Vice Chair Harder, and thank you, Chair Anderson, for bringing this bill. This has been a great discussion, and I'm glad you brought it to the table for us to have this discussion. A lot of things that have been mentioned, I can echo as well. And one thing I want to hit on, and I hear a lot from, and I'm on a rural or border of rural metro community on top of that, but young farmers. And I appreciate the fact that you don't want to exclude anybody. We just want to make sure that we open the opportunity up so that those that apply are equally looked at. And if I remember correctly, we did this last year with earmarks. And we had several earmark things and said, no, they're going to go to a grant program, which means more people have the opportunity to apply for it. So I appreciate that effort there as well. I want to go back and touch on, because a part that I think got overlooked a little bit is the part that Representative Godfrey brought up as far as the zoning use. I've had a chance to sit on zoning committees for many, many years. I think this is an important part that needs to be considered and included. I don't know if it's worded right. I'm not going to say, oh, this wording's perfect. But I do think in an application like this, we need to take into consideration, what is the zoning of the property that we're giving money to an applicant for? Will even agriculture, farming, flowers, whatever, be livestock, be allowed in that area? So there's some questions that have to be asked for that. If it's a piece of property that's commercial, that it can be, oh, we give some money out and 2 years later it's resold for double the price because it's going to be McDonald's. Those are some questions that this section tries to deal with. And so I appreciate it being in here. I'd love to, you know, work with the department to say, how does that need to be massaged to address those issues? But for especially somebody that's applying for this, to think through that process. What could this piece be in a year? Is a housing developer going to come in and want to put a couple more houses there? We want it to be for the long term. We want for the length of the business, the length of the farm, and make sure that those things are thought of as well. So just wanted to ask you that this is important. It just needs to be kind of dealt with a little bit further. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lawrence. Next on the list is Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Vice Chair Harder and Chair Anderson. So really, to expand on Representative Lawrence's train of thought here, zoning is there for a reason. And for, first of all, townships and cities, they all have the right to zone as they want to zone. And if you purchase a piece of property, it's really a contract between you and the government, and you're looking at that zoning, and you fully expect that you're not going to be subject to animal agriculture next door to you. So I think there's reasons for zoning, it's compatibility issues, and what could very innocently start as a quarter acre produce farm, well, then they learn that maybe chickens work good, and pretty soon they've got sheep, and then they want to have pigs. And so now we've got an investment into a residential area with a ag property. I think there's legalities that the townships and the cities and their zoning laws, I don't think we have the authority, or I don't know whether that's your intent, is to create an authority that would supersede their authority? I think those are all questions that need to be looked at. When most people buy a piece of property, they expect that it's going to be what it's zoned, and no one's coming in next door. I mean, if I want to do this in the country, there's a 1,500-foot setback for me to have animals next to a neighbor. 1,500 feet's a long ways. So I don't know if you've thought any of that through, or I mean, you've said that you're going to include residential. I think that's the wrong way to go. And the 2 acres then also keeps it out of, more likely to stay out of a residential area if 2 acres were the minimum.
Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, those are good points. And again, using reason and common sense, again, mention of livestock coming into an area that is zoned residential. Those are all things that have to be considered. I did hear that there's concern about limiting some folks that may want to do some type of gardening in a residential area. And if that can be worked out with local administration, zoning people, I wouldn't want to stop that. But there are reasons for some of these things to be put in statute, and they're there for a reason.
Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is more of a request for the department. Can we look at the data of folks who have applied for this program to really let us know, you know, how many of them fit into the criteria that we're discussing right now with regards to being residential or whatnot, so that we can clearly see the picture or that the need that have been requested of the program? Thank you.
All right. The department has released a report that does have that data in it, Representative Lee. Great. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll go quick. Chair Anderson, we were so close on a couple tweaks to this last year that didn't happen. This bill goes much farther than the things that we talked about, where we had a couple of options. But I would state, I want to go back to, you know, Representative Vang, that this when it was originated, it was the Emerging Farmer Program. But apparently the words emerging farmer were too much for some, so there was litigation, and then we had to remove the words emerging farmer. And we did that so that the program could survive. The way that most people become an emerging farmer is they win the hereditary lottery, and they're born into farming, or they marry into it. And now, in more recent years, maybe they have real estate that they sold, and they can tax benefit themselves into buying some property. So other states, we are stronger than other states where the corporations have limitations on buying property. Chair Anderson, you and I could go to our FSA offices today and sign up for programs for trade adjustment. I think the money from the federal government is available today. It's probably going to be, we could sign up and it would be on a per acre basis. There are Minnesotans who don't have the access to those programs, who want to get in farming, and many of them want to produce food, and they want to produce food for their local communities. We are born with privilege, those of us who are born on farms, that we don't even understand, because we have access to things that other people don't. And so I think to have a resilient agriculture, we have to have some of these opportunities to help people get into it. I think they want to. And to keep the culture in agriculture, we need to try to give some assistance there. And those of us who have, or our children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren who have that access, we have some benefits that other people don't. And we to level the field, to give that leg up to at least enter the system, I think is something that's worthwhile. And Representative Vang started that. I think we can continue to do that. It'll be harder with less money, but I think we need to keep a program going and try to make sure that it evolves to be beneficial for our state.
Chair Anderson.
Final comments, Madam Chair. The funding has increased up to $1.25 million. In previous years, it has not been allocated.
And again, I'm not against anybody getting into farming. And the piece of this bill, I think, that gives some heartburn is that doubling of the amount to somebody who has to purchase a bigger piece of ground to get into farming. And again, I will listen and talk and work with anybody that wants to keep this program going and make it succeed for all of farming. And with that, that's my comments.
All right, thank you. House File 3548 is laid over. The next bill is House File 3549, which is the grain indemnity account. Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill. Yes, 3549.
Thank you. Chair Anderson moves House File 3549 to put before the committee. Chair Anderson, to your bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. What this bill does is try to safeguard the money that's in the grain indemnity account that was created a couple of years ago. The state put in $10 million to get the program started. And since that time, the program has grown because of interest that's put on that $10 million. As of right now, it's about 10.8 or 9 million that's in the program. But there is a case that's going to be coming, or that is coming to the state as we speak. A firm in Nebraska that had operations in Minnesota went bankrupt. And the last I heard from the Department of Ag was about 20 producers have filed to be compensated because they weren't paid by this company. And the total is about $800,000 so far. And what this bill does, it says that we can't, I would say, raid the fund. And I would say I was part of that last year. We took $400,000 out of that account to help cover the cost of increases for inspecting grain elevators. And since the program now is going to be tapped, it's going to be used, the concern is we're going to get down low enough so that the ag commissioner is going to have to assess funds on all grain sold in the state to get the fund built back up again. If it drops down to 8 million, the commissioner has the authority to make all grain sold in the state subject to a fee. So what the bill does is say that we can't take money out of that fund anymore until it reaches full funding of 15 million. The money that comes out of that account has to be used for what it was intended for, administration of the program by the department, and then again the actual paying of farmers for the damages they suffer if they aren't paid by a company that's gone bankrupt. So there's no cost to it. I'm just trying to safeguard that the fund stays intact for what it's intended for. That's what this does.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I do not have any testifiers listed. Is there anybody here in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 3549? I am seeing none. Are there any questions from members? Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Anderson, as you mentioned earlier, when we negotiated this, I was ag chair at that time, and we gave $10 million to sit in the account. Do you intend to find more dollars to make it 15?
Do I what?
Do you intend to find the last 5 million to make it 15, considering just if that's something that you want to do, or?
Representative Anderson?
Well, right now, Representative Vang, the interest is accumulating about $300,000 to $400,000 a year. So, if it were never touched in 7 or 8 years, it would be fully funded.
Okay.
And then funds could be appropriated at that point. But the bill says until it reaches $15 million, and I was part of that last year, signed that bill that took $400,000 to lower the cost of assessments to elevators. But now when the fund is actually going to be used, it puts some light on the fact that we're talking real dollars here and want to safeguard that fund until it builds up to fully funded.
Okay.
Representative Vang?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Anderson. This grain indemnity fund, I think is definitely important. You know, we support farmers, and that is why we created the safety net for the grain farmers. I'm not sure if this language is necessary because I don't think we have any bills right now that intends to raid the fund, I guess. I'm not sure if this is just comfort language or if this is language is necessary. I think considering that this year's hot button issue is fraud, these companies that can go bankrupt for whatever reason, we may not know why. Worst case scenario is potentially fraud, I guess, and there's really no accountability when we have to pay out to these farmers. I definitely will be more interested in those type of language in terms of accountability and transparency. Should these elevator companies do go bankrupt, can't hold on their end of the bargain before, I guess, proceeding with this type of language.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Do you have any comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not quite sure what the point was that couldn't support this language. I'm not quite sure why. And I would agree with the point that is this language necessary because it specifically spells out in statute what it can be used for. And taking it to support some other type of project is not one of those listed uses. But it was tried a couple of years ago. And then last year we took it to help soften the blow of an increase of inspection fees, but that wasn't listed in the statute either. And I don't know how we were able to do it, but we did it. So what I'm saying is let's not touch the fund as it accrues interest until it's fully funded. And especially in this time when agriculture is in a very tight situation, it would not be good timing to send letters out saying, yeah, we're going to start assessing your grain you're selling at a loss already. I'm just saying let's leave the fund as it is and not touch it until it's fully funded. That's all this does.
Any other members? Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Vice Chair Harder. I just want to clarify, maybe nonpartisan or someone from the department could clarify, but to Representative Vang's question about the $15 million, am I right, if I remember correctly, that if the fund drops under $8 million, the fee kicks in and does not kick off again until $15
million? Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, yes, the fee would kick in. It's 0.02% on grain sales that the commissioner has the option to do the fee once it goes below $8 million. Yes.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair. So if they have the option, would it continue until it hit $15 million, or could the department or someone kick it off again? Because my understanding is it wouldn't blink off until 15.
Mr. Savory.
Chair members, from my memory, there is a clause within that references a hardship. So if there is an economic hardship out in the agricultural landscape, the commissioner could decide to not do the fee for that economic hardship, but the ceiling would be 15.
Thank you. Anyone else? Not Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think it's important to state that the $10 million was general tax dollar money. It wasn't farmer fees. It wasn't fees on any producers. It was part of the surplus, part of that $18 billion that was spending, that part of that spending. $10 million of it went into this, and $10 million is being used to cover unanticipated losses when there's a bankruptcy or fraud. And I think the important part, following up on Representative Vang, is that I raised this at the time. If you have somebody on an elevator who was a board of director, didn't do their due diligence, and then they are seeking reimbursement on something that they had a management decision on, which is a realistic possibility in the future, I think we should not have that. I think we should not reward people not doing their due diligence in their management positions with these boards. And so I think there's things that can be done. Was the motion to lay this over, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we're about out of time, so I'm glad that you're moving it to layover.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Chair Anderson, do you have any concluding remarks?
Boy, these were a couple of controversial bills today. This one that we're going to lay over, again, just trying to safeguard. And I think farmers are grateful to the state for putting that money aside in this account. Again, the poster child goes back to Ashby a number of years ago where farmers really took a beating. And this particular firm that we're dealing with today is in Nebraska that had an operation in Minnesota. Not the farmer's fault. And if there's court proceedings and there's recovery, that money would come back again to the state to help replenish this fund again. So that's my final comment, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. With that, House File 3549 is laid over. With no other items before this committee, we are adjourned.